Confused about when does Advent really begin? And to tell you the truth, I think it begins next week, because then we have 4 weeks of Advent. But Allison and I, when we were dealing with this question, we just said, hey, let's just start it a week early. I said I was going to preach a series of sermons anyway, and I've given Allison a list of those sermons up through Christmas Eve, which will be a part of this series. What we do with Epiphany and the dates after that, I'm not quite sure yet. But I'm sure you've heard me say this before. In fact, I may have said it last week. After preaching for more than 40 years, it can get very difficult, at least for me, trying to find something new to say about really the same old subjects. How many times can you be inventive or creative with the shepherds in the fields or the coming of the Magi or any of the other things that we associate with these weeks of Advent? Well, this year we're going to start this new series on what I'm calling the mixed up stories of Christmas. So hopefully we can get a little bit different take. This year, we're going to be celebrating the fact that God doesn't always do things the way we expect that he might do them. We're going to look at how God uses people that are too old, people who are too young, people who do it in the wrong place, and those who do it at the wrong time. And hopefully, if we can progress through that, then we will finally get to people who give too much. I thought about writing a sermon about people that give too little, but that one is a question mark right now. And yet, after seeing all of this over roughly the next 5 or 6 weeks, we will begin to see how God can use all of us for the very redemption of the world. So even if God doesn't work things out the way we expect that he might, it shouldn't matter to any of us, because we will soon realize that he never does things our way. He doesn't come and say, oh, John, what should I do this year that's different than what we did last year? But you see, no matter how God works things out, I think in the end we will realize that that's perfectly okay. Now let's face it, in all the years we've walked the face of this planet, God hasn't done it our way or in any of our lives in a way that we expect. Has he? Has God ever been surprising to you? Or is he always surprising to you? Now think about that. Now, I know that the older you are, that God has been good to you throughout many more years. God has protected you through all of your years. He has blessed you over and over again. And even when difficulties have come into your life, if you have stayed close to God, he has helped you to work your way through those difficulties. But he just hasn't done anything in a way that we expected him to do them. It's not that we didn't expect him to act, but when we begin to try and control God by telling him how he should act, then we are very often surprised. He does things that we never expect him to do in the way that he does it. We never expect him to use those people to carry out his plans or to accomplish through those particular situations. Whatever those situations might be, that he will ultimately accomplish his plan in the world. But regardless of how God has worked in your life, in all the things that we have witnessed in our life, we continue to see the sovereign hand of God and see that God indeed is true to his promises to be with us, to continue his protection over us, and to bless us not only materially and physically, but emotionally and spiritually as well. Here's the thing. As we begin this season of Advent, we will see this very same occurrence throughout the Christmas story as well. So we often look at this question of Christmas through what I call the rose-colored glasses of 20 centuries of celebrating this holiday and getting farther and farther and farther away from the truth of what really happened. Like it or not, that is one of the reasons, I think, that we use decorations. And we not only at home do we use them, but we use them here. Because I think that is where we can begin to feel comfortable, using those sanitized angels and those very well-behaved donkeys and so many other things that help us explain what really took place so very long ago. But for Elizabeth and Zechariah, who will be the first people that we look at this Christmas season, this wasn't the way they entered that first Christmas season. They didn't have all of those pictures in their head. They didn't see the courier and Ives sleigh rides through the snow, or the Thomas Kincaid pictures with the little houses with the lights shining out of the windows. They couldn't imagine God doing something wonderful through a Savior that he said was coming into the world. They only had a very tiny picture, and their small picture was that they had been empty and brittle as a couple for many, many years. But all the while, they were holding on to God. That's the key in this whole story. They hoped that God would somehow bless their family with a child. And so this picture for them symbolizes where they were as a family at that time. You see, God chose to work in a country that probably, had it not been for Judaism and later Christianity, we wouldn't know very much about. We wouldn't care at all what went on there. Israelite would mean no more to us than Jebusites. And the only reason we know about the Jebusites is because we have the Old Testament from the Israelites. Yet God chose to work in that little obscure country. And he didn't even choose to work in them at a time when they were at their zenith. The God's plan of salvation that he began to put into effect as he rescued them from foreign captivity in Egypt. After 400 years of them being downtrodden and oppressed by other people, and under the complete power of those other nations, he chose to begin work on this great plan of salvation. That's not to say that God didn't have that plan in his mind from the beginning of time. But we're saying that he really began to put that plan into motion as he used Moses to lead the nation of Israel out of their captivity and into the promised land. And out of this, mind you, things that he did in unexpected ways, God brings or brought redemption to the world that he had created. But the way God chose to work in history and the way he chose to work in our lives begins to tell us something great about the very character of God. And the Christmas story is especially clear on who God is and why he acts the way he does. Notice that he doesn't use a military leader to come forward and lead us to deliverance. He doesn't take a person who is rich in human terms and use them, lest we might think even for a moment that somehow riches are involved in our own salvation. He takes poor, unknown people from a poor country, and I think that begins to tell us at least a little bit about who God is and how God acts. God's ways are not our ways. And as Paul tells us in 1 Corinthians 1:25, for the foolishness of God is wiser than man's wisdom, and the weakness of God is stronger than man's strength. Now let's go back and take a quick look at Zechariah here. He was a priest in the hill country of Judea. Elizabeth, you will find out next week, is really Mary's cousin. I think you probably knew all of that before. But in verse 6 of our passage today, and let me, I'm going to read a piece of this. I had told Allison just to put down Luke chapter 1, but it's a rather comprehensive chapter. And in the days of Herod, king of Judea, there was a priest named Zechariah. He was of the division of Abijah. And he had a wife from the daughters of Aaron, and her name was Elizabeth. And they were both righteous before God, walking blamelessly in all the commandments and statutes of the Lord. But they had no child, because Elizabeth was barren, and both were advanced in years. Now, while he was serving as a priest before God, when his division was on duty, according to the custom of the priesthood, he was chosen by lot to enter the temple of the Lord and to burn incense. And the whole multitude of the people were praying outside at the hour of incense. And there appeared to him an angel of the Lord standing on the right side of the altar of incense. And Zechariah was troubled when he saw him, and fear fell upon him. But the angel said to him, "Do not be afraid, Zechariah, for your prayer has been heard, and your wife Elizabeth will bear you a son, and she shall call his name, or you shall call his name, John." I'm going to stop there. But I just wanted you to have that little bit of a heads up about what part of this story from Luke chapter 1 that we're dealing with right now. Now, we know that these were good folks, Elizabeth and Zechariah. Now, they are good because the scripture here tells us that they observe all of the Lord's commandments. But they are not particularly respected people in their community. They're, first off, not from the right part of the country, and I think that can happen to almost anyone. And when it becomes Zechariah's time to go into the temple to burn incense on the altar, this angel of the Lord appears to him and promises him that he and Elizabeth will have a child. Now there's the first unexpected thing. This old, infertile couple have been promised by God that they will have a child. Now, these folks have been praying for this child for years. They've at least been praying that God would do something in their life to make it outstanding. They had borne for years what I'm going to call the shame of being childless, because in that culture, to not have a child was seen as a part of God's judgment against them. So they buried their shame in that place, and praying their prayers and always hoping that God would do something. But you see, what happens, and this has happened to all of us at one point or another, they realized that their time of hoping was behind them. It was over and finished. There can come a time in each of our lives that no matter how much we believe, no matter how much we hope, we begin to think that the time for what we really want has passed us by. And you can convince yourself that you better get used to it. It can be that time, the time for getting married, we'll say, is over. The time for child rearing is over. Or how about the time for making a job change? But at some point in your life, that time is over as well. There are all kinds of times that occur to us in our life. And we have this internal clock in us that keeps on ticking. Now, Zechariah and Elizabeth, of course, they wanted things to change. They had certainly gone past the time for having children. That would have been many years ago for Elizabeth. And now their hopes were dead because they were just too old. See, we hear similar things all the time. It doesn't matter what the subject is. Too old to have a baby? Sure. We're too old to learn something new. Are we all just old dogs? Are we too old to change? See, there are so many times in life when we come up with this excuse. And these are easy excuses to make in our culture because our culture is essentially obsessed with youth. We live in a culture that sells tons and tons of cosmetics, and some of them, a good portion, to men. Plastic surgery is a booming industry in this country. It's easy for us to think that there are times that you become too old for something, but one of the things that we see in Luke 1 is that God is never willing to write us off because of our age. These people are not too old to have a child in God's way of thinking, but they believe that they are way past that age themselves. But here's the thing, because of God's sovereign purposes, he holds off on an answer that he could have given to them any time earlier in their life. But he gives it to them later because he is weaving that part of the story into a series of events that are far bigger than anything that this old couple could ever imagine. This is the very longing of Israel, waiting for their Messiah to come. And it is about to come to fruition in Jesus Christ. And Zechariah and Elizabeth are woven into being just a small part of that. Because as we read in our song today, their son will be the one who comes before Jesus, crying, "Prepare the way for the Lord." And it all begins with this, I think, a miraculous birth of their child, who we now call John the Baptist. He was Jesus' cousin. But there are a number of things for us to learn from this passage. And the first one is this. There is a call upon all of us, and I underlined all, to serve God and to continue to do that from the beginning to the end, from the start to the finish. There is never a time when we become too old to be used of God in the plan that he has already established. I want to tell you about a woman by the name of Sissy Davis. Maybe some of you have heard of her. Sissy was a woman who lived down in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. And she has this amazing Mississippi accent, which may be a clue to where her roots really lie. She spent most of her life driving a school bus. No big deal, right? Sounds like my mother-in-law. That my mother-in-law managed to turn hers over on its side once. Anyway, this gal, Sissy, was a single mother. Obviously, as a school bus driver, she had very little money. She was working really hard to raise her kids. I'm not sure how many she had, but it sounds like, at times, reading her story, she sounds like the old woman who lived in a shoe and had so many children, she didn't know what to do. Well, finally, she's in her 50s, And all of the children have departed from her house. And she finally meets a man and she gets married. But that's not what this story is about. In 1993, Sissy is well past 50, and she's praying to God something like this. God, let me do something significant in my life. I don't want to go on and pass away without having left a mark somehow. So God, I know I'm just a school bus driver. I'm a poor woman with no education. But can you use me? Can you use me? If you're not ready to go to work, I would say that's a question you need not ask God, because he will find a ministry for you to begin working in. Well, it was only a short time after she prayed that prayer that the pastor of her church got a phone call from a hospital. And they were saying that they needed little tiny outfits for premature babies that passed away at birth or soon after. Now, I don't know if you've ever thought about this, but when a baby is small enough, they don't fit in to regular baby clothes. Like a onesie would make them disappear. And so there's hospitals all over the country that have families that are in a similar situation. They're going through this grief and this time of crisis in their life. And somebody in the family has to go to the toy store and buy doll clothes to wrap up this baby. Or the hospital just wraps the baby in a blanket, or sometimes even wraps that dead baby in paper. So the pastor talked to Sissy, and he said, "Can you do something about this?" All of a sudden, there is the answer to the prayer that she asked God, "Can you use me?" So she took $100 that someone had given her, and she bought a bolt of cloth, and she started cutting out these little tiny baby clothes. And thus, she began a ministry to these families where she could give the clothes to the hospitals, and then when there was an infant death, these families could be helped without having the embarrassment of going to the toy store to buy some clothes for that little baby's funeral. You see, in God's sovereign way, word got out. It always has a way of getting out. Her story appeared on television, and it appeared in a national magazine. And then shortly after, women all over the country started calling Sissy and saying, "We have experienced this kind of loss ourselves. We want to help other women, other families that are going through this very crisis." And Sissy called her ministry the Threads of Love. There are now over 100 chapters around the country, and they have given away thousands upon thousands of items to help other families in this time of grief. There's a chapter just down the road in Washington, Illinois. That, I think, is the closest one around here. But when this ministry began, Sissy was in her 50s. And that was more than 20 years ago. And I understand that Sissy is still going strong as a leader of that movement. You see, my friends, there is never a time when God stops working in our lives. And there never will be a time when he expects us to stop working in some sort of ministry, either in the church or outside of it. And if there are any of us, maybe I'm just speaking to Allison here this morning, but you need to remember as well that the slow years, the empty years, will never be wasted years. Think for a moment about Elizabeth and Zechariah. But think not when this story begins and when we're first introduced to them, but think about them 20 years before. Zechariah is working as a country priest. And they're going through life just day in and day out. They're praying for their family that they want so badly. And nothing happens to them year after year after year. Are those wasted years for Elizabeth and Zechariah? Not if they stay close to God during that whole time. And it says in verse 6 that they were upright and obeyed the commandments of the Lord. And you see, that's what kept those years from being wasted years. Because in the middle of this seeming emptiness, in the middle of their struggles and their shame, they worked hard to stay close to God. You think about it. God prepared Jesus for 30 years before he began his ministry of only 3 years. And that's often how God works. And it's not easy for us to see in our situation how God could possibly be using this time to prepare us for the future. Because we all know that life doesn't fit into those little square boxes. Life doesn't track along straight lines. When you are, where you are and what you are doing right now can be a part of what God is doing to shape you if you respond by staying close to him. Remember this, God's primary task is not preparing us for ministry. God's primary task seems to be making us to become more like his only son, Jesus Christ. The people who built this church, and we just celebrated 130 years of this church's existence, they went through the same struggles that we are facing today. Maybe not in numbers, but think about 130 years ago. Maybe they had 5 or 6 people that decided to build a church. I'm not certain of the history of this church. But at one point, early in its progression, this might have been a large crowd for that group. And we have what? 4, 7, 4, 11, 12, 13 people here today. That might have been a very large crowd at the beginning of this church. So anyway, they went through the same struggles that we are facing. And it is because they never gave up working, and they never understood that they would not do whatever it took to grow this church and to help this church survive. It's because of that very reason that we are worshiping here this morning. They made the same sorts of choices that we make, and they shared the same sorrows that we have. But we all need to remember that we only have to be 1 or 2 steps in front of those that are coming behind us in order for us to have something to share with those who come along. We have what I like to call a wealth of maturity in this congregation. It surrounds us, and we need to be creative, or to become creative, in how we use that wealth. Maybe this is your opportunity simply to invite someone over for dinner, rather than waiting around for them to invite you. That might never happen. But you can go out and find a neighbor or someone that you work with, or someplace there is someone who's waiting for that invitation from you. No matter what your age, and in a sense, no matter what your health, until the very end of life, there will always be a new response at every stage of your life. And what's really amazing is that in the economy of God, once we get to the end And we are making our very last responses to God to be faithful in this life. We need to realize that that is not the end. But it is just a start of something that is bigger and better than where we are right now. God is never finished with us. That means all of us. And to that, I say amen.